So, one of my favorite authors is a guy named C.S. Lewis. I love C.S. Lewis. I will admit, there's a lot of stuff he writes I have to read again and again and again and again in order to fully grasp it. But I just think he is an incredible theologian, an incredible author, an incredible lecturer. One of my favorite things he wrote is a speech. It's a speech he gave in 1944 to the student body at King's College, which is part of University of London. And you know, when people generally give speeches to student bodies at universities, they usually offer a word of encouragement, of inspiration. But in this particular speech, Mr. Lewis offered a warning, if you will. He began to talk about this phenomenon in society that he called the inner ring. And he wanted the students to know that they will always encounter this inner ring. It's a group of people who are together. We would call them, in a negative sense, cliques, right? And what Mr. Lewis, what frustrated him is he watched human nature and he realized that most of us, well, really all of us, will do whatever it takes to be part of an inner ring. We will be who we are. We will sell what we have. We will do whatever the group does. We will compromise our values. We will whatever it takes, because we all yearn to be part of this inner ring. And his warning was this. I think it's fascinating that when you get finally, if you get included into the inner ring, you know what you find? Another inner ring, and then another inner ring, and another inner ring. And he said, this happens in all of society, no matter where you are, whether you're retired or a student, whether you're an engineer or a school teacher, whether you're a physician's assistant or a nurse or a doctor, whether you're a music director, a children's director, a youth director, or a preacher. You're going to find these inner rings in schools, in the workplace, in Little League, in communities, and even in church. And Mr. Lewis warned these students to not get so driven that they lose who they are just to be in. Because no matter what group you're in, there's always going to be a group you're out. And the negative part of cliques or inner rings is that people are often excluded for no good reason. Now, C.S. Lewis was a whole lot smarter than I will ever be. He's a better preacher, better lecturer, better author than I will ever dream of being. But if Mr. Lewis were to ask me what I thought of his speech, I would tell him it was one of the most profound speeches I've ever read. But I would also want him to know that I think he left out one very important part. See, because I wish, far be it from me to correct C.S. Lewis, but I wish Mr. Lewis would include just a little passage of scripture from the first letter of John. I mean, listen to what it says. This would have been perfect. Here's what it says. We announce to you what existed from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have seen and our hands handled, about the word of life. The life was revealed, and we have seen, and we testify and announce to you the eternal life that was with the Father and was revealed to us. What we have seen and heard, we also announce it to you so that you can have fellowship with us. Here's a part. Our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. We are writing these things so our joy may be complete. Now, if Mr. Lewis would have included that, he would have been able to tell this group of students at University of London, King College, that they didn't have to strive to be part of that inner ring, or that inner ring, or that inner ring, because they were already invited to be part of an inner ring. An inner ring where no one is excluded and everyone is included. An inner ring that is made up of the community of fellowship of God the Father and Jesus the Son. Now, those of you who've been around, you know that right there is one of the heartbeats of my theology. That the reason why we were created in the first place by God wasn't because He was bored one day, wasn't because He needed someone to order around, wasn't because He needed anything or wanted anything. What God created us for, because God was experiencing this community in this mystery that we call the Trinity. And it was so beautiful and so perfect that the Genesis writer told us He created us in His own image so that we too can experience the shalom and the beauty and the love and the peace of that. And that's what the story of the letter of John was all about. We're beginning this summer of love, if you will, and we're going to work our way through the first letter of John. Now, there are three letters attributed to John, very cleverly named. Ready? 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. It's incredible titles, right? Now, the problem with 1 John is there is no mention of who might have written it, okay? 2 and 3 John, it is mentioned. It is written that it was John the Apostle. Now, most scholars or some scholars believe it was written by John the Apostle simply because the language is so similar to the Gospel of John. We're going to see a little bit of that next week. And there are people who spend their time debating who wrote it, when it was written. Let's just agree that for this series, it was written by the Apostle John in the first century, okay? Now, it wasn't written to one specific church. It was written to this community of churches. It was written to a community of churches that were divided and being persecuted. They were divided and being persecuted over a theology known as Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge. And there were two branches to Gnosticism that were evident in the first century. One branch said that the human body is evil, and because it's evil, whenever you sinned, you needed to be severely disciplined. Then you had this other branch that said, well, the human body doesn't mean anything, so you can eat, drink, be merry, do whatever the heck you want because it doesn't matter. And this theology was dividing the church, and the one common thing they had is that neither branch believed that Jesus was human in any form. Which is why John begins his thing, we have seen this, we have handled him. We know he was man and God. See, the central thesis of the Christian faith is that somehow in a mystery that we can't understand, in the incarnation on Christmas Day, God became flesh. And in Jesus, God, it was fully human, fully God. And if you understand how that is, you can write a book and make a fortune. It's just a mystery, right? But the Gnostics believed that wasn't how it was. And they were persecuting the church, they were dividing the church, and it was a mess. And to that, John wrote this letter. And in it, he starts by saying, no matter what's going on the outside, I'm here to tell you that this Jesus, he was fully human. We touched him. We ate with him. We walked with him. And John spends this letter talking about the ministry and work of Jesus, of why it even mattered that Jesus came. And that's the theme of this letter. And for John, it all begins and is wrapped around and ends with the understanding that because of Jesus, we are all invited into this fellowship with God, into what I like to call the fellowship of the ring, of God's ring. And we are invited, embraced, accepted, and chosen by God. Now, there was a time in my life where I really could have used to hear those words. Now, and you know, I went to a therapist, they would tell you it's because my dad abandoned me and all that, you know, whatever. But I know this. I know that there was a point in my life where I longed to hear that I was included, not excluded. That I was part of an inner ring. And I can tell you right when it was. When we first moved to Melbourne, Florida, I was in seventh grade. And I got one of the worst years in my life was seventh grade at Central Junior High School, Melbourne, Florida. I hated every single day that I had to go to school. I mean, because, you know, I was a new kid. I didn't know anybody. I talked with a funny accent, and believe it or not, I was scrawny and kind of geeky back then. I know, it's hard to believe. And the worst part of every single day of my seventh grade year was PE, sixth period. I used to dread it all day long. Now, I don't know how they do it in PE then, but PE now. I mean, how they do PE now, but they did it then. We would play these team sports, right? Except for like 6 weeks, and then we would square dance. Don't ask me how that's PE. But for the other time, right, we would play these team sports. And we would play, and it didn't matter whether it was soccer, or kickball, dodgeball, softball, flag football, whatever it was we were playing. The coach would always do the same thing. And I don't know where they taught coaches to do this. They would pick two captains, right? And the kids who were captains were always the coolest of all kids. They were the inner ring, right? And so they would pick the captains, which for the record, for the entire year of seventh grade, however many days of misery I had to endure, never once was I the captain. They would pick these captains, and then the punishment and humiliation would begin. Because the captains would then begin picking teams. Remember that? Horrible. Now, there are some of you out there who are cool and athletic and, you know, good looking and smart. I'm sure there's one of you out there that way. Yeah, Don Cooper raises his hand. Don, no. Son, let me assure you, you would have not been one of the captains. No engineer was ever a captain. But some of you were probably captains. So you don't understand. And some of you were probably the first ones chosen, right? Because everybody wanted you on their team because you could do whatever. But then there were those of us who no one knew, had a funny accent, kind of scrawny, geeky kid, who would always be one of the last two or three chosen. And I don't know where they teach these captains to do it, but they go to captain school. Because they make it even worse than it is. When it's finally two or three left, captain would shrug his shoulders, give a big sigh. All right, I'll take him. That was my seventh grade year. And I often wonder how my life would have been different if someone would have whispered in my ear, Marty, you don't have to be the first one chosen. You don't have to even be captain. Because the God who created all that was and is and will ever be has invited you into his inner ring. You, just the way you are invited into the fellowship of the ring. I don't know how my life might have turned different, what path I might have done better if someone way back then would have pointed out this simple truth in John's letter. Because I spent my junior high years striving, driving, and achieving to be part of this inner ring. And it motivated me, but it also ate at me. Now, I know some of you out there, you had the same experience I did. You're never good enough, never smart enough, never athletic enough, never good-looking enough, never had the right hair or the right complexion or the right body shape or whatever it is. You grew up the same way I did. And I know there's some of us out here right now who feel the exact same way even today. We feel excluded rather than included. We know the hurt and the pain and the humility of being on the outside looking in. Well, if that's you, I want you to hear this again. What we have seen and heard, we also announce to you so that you can have fellowship with us. For our fellowship is with the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ. And our joy will be complete. See, what John is telling us, because of what Jesus has done, there's no one on the outside. There's no one rejected. We are all invited into this fellowship of the ring. Now, I have been amazed today, the other two services. I share with people my favorite children's book, one of my favorite. And it's right underneath there with Harold and the Purple Crayon. And a lot of people never read it. One of my favorite children's book is Dr. Seuss, The Sneetches. Anybody know that book? Anybody read it? Anybody not read the book? Wow. Man, there are some deprived people here. I'm sure you read Green Eggs and Ham, right? Of course. That's the one everyone reads, Cat in the Hat, Thing One and Thing Two. But the best book he wrote is called The Sneetches. Now, for those of you who've never read it, you should go get it, but there's no movie, so you can't wait for the movie. But in this book are these Sneetches. And these Sneetches are tall, yellow creatures that live on beaches because Dr. Seuss has to rhyme everything. Right? So they couldn't live in the jungle because that wouldn't have rhymed with Sneetches. So they lived on beaches. And there were two groups of Sneetches. There was a Sneetch with the stars on their belly, and there was a Sneetch, see, without the star on their belly, right? And the star belly Sneetches were the in group. They were on the inner ring. They were the cool kids. They were the captains. They were the first ones picked. They were one everybody wanted to be with. And if you read Dr. Seuss, they would be the ones having a little campfire and making s'mores and singing campfire songs and holding hands, singing Kumbaya and Pass It On and talking about the love of God. But the whole time, on the outside of the campfire, on the outside, peeking in, were these Sneetches that had no star upon thar, because he had to rhyme. He couldn't use the word there because that wouldn't rhyme with star, right? And so the Sneetches without were excluded. They were just losers. And then one day, a guy by the name of, you want to put the slide up? Sylvester McMonkey McBean showed up to town. And he was driving this incredible machine. Get it? McBean, machine, it rhymes. And for a mere $3, if you were a star without a Sneetch without a star upon thar, if you were a plain belly Sneetch, you could give $3, go through his machine, and lo and behold, come out with a star, because he had a star on machine, right? So of course, all the plain belly Sneetches would go in and give their $3 happily, come out with their stars. And soon the original star belly Sneetches were losing their mind because now you couldn't tell who was who, right? And so, but not to worry, because Mr. McBean had another machine, the star off machine. And for a mere $10, you could go through the machine and you'd have your star taking off your belly. Well, this went on all day, $3, $10, $10, $3, star belly on, off machine, on machine, off machine, on machine. And at the end of the day, when the Sneetches had no more money, Mr. McBean drives off with his machine with all their money, and the Sneetches are sitting on the beaches, not knowing who was who. In fact, this is how Dr. Seuss puts it. Can you put it up on the screen? Neither the plain nor the star bellies knew whether this one was that one or that one was this one or which one or what one was who. It's a brilliant book. And he never mentions 1 John. But it's the message of the book. It's the same message. Because see, When God saw us, he saw us as Sneetches without stars. And then according to John, Jesus did what Jesus did, the work and the ministry and the death and the crucifixion and the resurrection. And it didn't matter. All of us who were excluded became included. All of us who were on the outside were invited to come on the inside. Not by some guy with a machine, but we were invited by the God who was, who is, and who will always be. The God who created all of it invites you and me into his fellowship of the ring. But you know there's a catch, right? Because those of us who have been invited in the fellowship of the ring, those of us who are included, we can no longer exclude. And the reason why we're here is so that the world out there, the least, the last, the lost, black, white, free, slave, Jew, Gentile, Republican, Democrat, gay, straight, winner, loser, tall, short, skinny, not skinny, smart, not so smart, so that all of God's children will be invited. Back in the summer of 1967, a group of people got together in San Francisco. And the reason why they got together, if you study your history, they came together looking for love and acceptance. They were wondering who they were and whose they were. And when they couldn't get an answer to that, when they couldn't find love and acceptance, when they weren't embraced and included, they turned to drugs and to sex. And the summer of love in 1967 was defined by that. But that's not how it started. And I often wonder what would have happened if someone said to that little group of people that gathered together and said, hey, you got to remember who you are. You're a child of God. And whose you are. You belong to the King of Kings. I wonder if the summer of 1967 would have had a different history. Because I know my life went a different way when someone finally told me that good news. This week, when 250, 300 kids are here, that's what we're about. So that those, the least, the last, and the lost, will be invited into God's fellowship of the ring. That's the gospel. And that's what this summer of love is all about. To remember who we are and whose we are. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.